Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Spectator podcast. I'm joined today by Sven Hughes, who is the CEO of a company called Verbalization. And Sven used to work for SCL Group, which is the parent company of Cambridge Analytica. And he's got rather an interesting story to tell us about his time there and his work there. And so, Sven, thank you for coming in, first of all.
Lovely to be here. Thank you. Thank you, Freddie.
And I'd like to ask you about sort of how you came to be involved in SCL. Well, I'll keep calling it Cambridge Analytica, but when you were working for them, they were called SCL Group.
That's right.
And how you came to work for them, your background a bit. I mean, I think you started in the Army, is that right?
Or that's right, as a reservist, yes, that's right.
So take us from the Army to SCL and what okay. happened there.
Well, my background is twofold. I was a reservist in something called psychological operations, and then in support of British Special Forces. And running parallel to that, I was working in the advertising industry as a associate creative director, copywriter at a big advertising agency in London. Mm. And I was sort of headhunted into SCL to join them as their head of elections in about 2009.
Right. And who asked you to do that? Was that Alexander Nix?
That's Alexander Nix, yes. So he was actually presenting to our company at the time, and we were talking through the meeting. I think he was interested by some of the things I was saying. Mm. And I think I'm right in saying one of his colleagues had actually been to a lecture I'd given several weeks before about behaviour change and behaviour change methodologies. Yeah. And so he offered me a job on the way to the lift on the way out.
Okay.
And said, can you start in
a couple of weeks? We might be getting ahead of ourselves. Let's go back a little bit and talk about, you know, PsyOps. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I think a lot of people, skeptics like me, when they hear things like PsyOps, they think sort of psychological mumbo-jumbo, that sort of thing. I mean, I know you're quite evangelical, I think it would be fair to say, about the possibilities of PsyOps. I mean, what were you doing in the Army in terms of PsyOps that led you to think there are great opportunities here? Was that why Nix was attracted to you as someone to hire?
Okay. Right, there's a lot of questions there. First of all, in terms of if you think PsyOps is mumbo-jumbo, let me just sort of address that. It is more effective and it is more morally acceptable to use influence techniques and to engage in dialogue than it is to shoot someone in the head. So if we can start there, you can't change anyone's mind if you've killed them. Mm. Yeah? And a lot of our foreign policy was leaning towards shooting first and creating dialogue second. I think it is much more responsible and have always believed in dialogue over division, which is, and I was personally involved in several different operations in Afghanistan, where we demonstrated categorically by engaging in proper, robust, almost scientific dialogue with the Taliban, we were able to save a great deal of life on both sides, and there are many instances of that. So far from it being mumbo-jumbo, and I think we can see that with the hybrid threat that we're facing from Russia at the moment, not a shot was fired in Crimea to annex Crimea. I mean, this is highly effective. You know, there is a great deal of science in support of some of these techniques. It just is unfortunate by its name. You know, the idea of PsyOps, some people call it PsychOps.
Yes.
You know, so I think that's probably a name that's gone down in history, and whether or not influence operations or information operations are a more appropriate name.
And in a way, perhaps Alexander Nix has set, if you think, believe in this stuff, has set your cause back in the sense, because he's now given it a bad name. People will think of it as of Cambridge Analytica selling sort of snake oil psychological stuff to the Trump campaign.
It certainly makes me furious, and I know some of my colleagues, both in my own company and in other companies, where there is a great deal of good work and responsibility and ethics and morality in terms of this industry. Turning our back on a marketing industry that used to be almost like an arms race, which has put as much information out there as you can afford, you know, as many posters you can afford, and just have the same line on all of them and just flood the messaging environment, and some of it will stick. Well, that's a huge amount of wastage. It's highly expensive. It's not at all targeted. It's essentially quite irresponsible, really. It's a very old-fashioned way of doing things. What a lot of the industry has been doing is moving towards more a targeted, empathic messaging that takes into account talking with people rather than talking at them.
Right.
So in answer to your question, yes, this Cambridge Analytica story has without any question the risk of besmirching a great deal of good effort and good work that's been done over many years.
Okay, okay. Well, we'll go back to that in a bit. But now let's go back to where you were before I distracted you, which is your first meeting with Nix, who had obviously heard you speak, presumably about empathetic messaging, and said to you, I've got a job offer for you. Can you give me your sort of first impressions of Alexander Nix, who is obviously now quite a notorious figure because of his role in Cambridge Analytica?
Okay, I mean, I'll keep this light because it's not my place to sort of besmirch an individual or defame a company that's already being investigated. But certainly Alexander is remarkably charming, remarkably compelling, has an extreme...
Classic old Etonian.
Well, again, I'm not. You know, these are very.
Everyone wants to do that.
These are trite comments. I mean, you know, he is a very, very fast-thinking, adept businessman, and whether or not that has perhaps been his failing in terms of perhaps being too keen to oversell and underdeliver might be arguably perceived as a failing of his now. But certainly from the first impression, it's very hard not to be impressed by the sheer character that walks into the room and the compelling nature of him as a man.
And had you heard of SEL Group when...
Yes.
And did you have a sort of admiration for them?
Absolutely, particularly for one person, actually. There's a man called Nigel Oakes, who's, I think, the founder of SEL, who... over many years has been at certainly the progressive end of behavioural science, comes from a very sort of robust scientific background, bases his work on assessed based on the evidence rather than hype and snake oil. And I've been, and continue to be when I work with him as well, very impressed by him as a man. So I was aware of them and was keen to go to that meeting as a consequence of actually, ideally, hopefully meeting Nigel Oakes, as it was Alexander turned up.
So you were excited by this offer?
Yes, yeah. I mean, of course. I mean, I was being offered to go to the Caribbean and run elections and double my wage and start in 2 weeks. Of course I was. Yeah.
And it was that quick, was it?
Yes.
You'll start in 2 weeks. Yep. So then your first port of call was the Caribbean. Where was your first?
I went over to run the election. So I joined them as head of elections, and I went over to run the election in St. Kitts and Nevis for the then incumbent Prime Minister Denzel Douglas, who was, as far as I still know, an extremely good man, a very good candidate with a very good team around him and with a good message to tell. As I joined the campaign, he was losing in the polls, as I was led to believe. And essentially what we needed to do was put together a comprehensive and coherent messaging strategy and an advertising campaign, essentially election campaign, to get his points across in a way that would resonate with the public.
And how much time did you have to do this?
Well, it was a little bit unsure in terms of when the election was going to be called, because, of course, that's it, the Prime Minister's right to decide when to call an election, and then you have a 30-day period until the actual election day. As it turned out, I was there with him for a year.
And did you at that time meet, because this is a story I'm very interested in, did you at that time meet Christian Kalin?
That's an interesting name. Yes, Chris Kalin was a name I certainly heard mentioned at that early stage of the campaign. I didn't meet him, as it transpired. The way that we were asked to engage with him was through the use of Skype or through the use of sort of invisible email accounts, which you would neither send or receive an email, but rather you would save your correspondence into the drafts folder. Mm. And Chris was... he's a senior person in a company called Henley & Partners, or Henley Associates. Yeah. And yes, it was a name I came across quite soon into things.
And did you at this stage, obviously it's very easy with hindsight to say you should have smelled a rat, did you at this stage think that there was something strange about the way that SEL operated? Did you think this figure of Kalin was slightly suspicious, that he was sort of selling passports and yet seemed to be involved in the election?
Within 2 weeks, I had the conversation with Alexander Nix, which is, I'm worried to be here ethically, morally, and in some of the things I'm seeing. To which Alexander said to me, well, if we told you the truth, you wouldn't have joined us. So at that point, I had a choice, which was either leave at that point or actually try and reshape it in a more professional, responsible way to run a good, decent election for a very good candidate, as I understood it. So that's what I set about doing, was building a team in my image. And hiring people.
I don't want to get ahead of us. What was the team that was already in place when you went to St. Kitts and Nevis? Was there a sort of SEL campaign up and running then? And you
No, I was sort of the first person onto the ground. Some people were flown in from the SEL team. They didn't last long in my team. I found fault with them on professional grounds quite quickly and quite quickly returned them back to London and instead hired in people that I felt were more competent and capable of delivering the standard and the quality that I wanted to see.
Okay, so you did St Kitts and Nevis, and that was a success?
Yes, we won the election,
You won the election. And so then how quickly did you move on to the next campaign? Because I think you
Before the end of St Kitts, I was already doing the referendum in St Vincent, and around the same time was starting to do an election in Trinidad and Tobago as well.
And can you give me a sense of how this would operate? So Nick's would be, would say to you, right, we've got this contract now for the Grenadines or something like that, come and do that.
Yes.
He would be sort of emailing you saying, now go here, now
yes,
go there.
Yes, it was a conversation between Chris Kalin and Alexander Nix in terms of who was going to be represented from in any campaign in the region.
Yeah.
And then my job was to run that campaign.
And did you feel that Nix was always your boss, or did you think that Chris Kalin was also your boss? Did you get the sort of feeling you're working for...
Well, no, I mean, nominally, in terms of contractually, I wasn't employed by SCL. And so to that extent, Alexander Nix was my boss. He would fly in to the islands where I was working perhaps once every 6 weeks, 2 months for a few days, and then fly back to London. I would certainly be talking to him on the phone every day, but also similarly to Chris Callan every day or at least every few days. So, yes, I was absolutely employed by SCL.
So Nix in this Channel 4 documentary... admitted to dirty tricks, sting operations and so on. When did that first come onto your radar that that was the sort of thing you'd be doing?
Well, it wasn't the sort of thing I was intending to do or wanting to do or sort of chose to do or actioned in some respect. I was winning the election as far as I'm concerned and similarly won all the campaigns I did for them subsequently by running a clean campaign and by representing good candidates with, you know, clean campaigning skills. Mm. In each campaign, there was an occasion where between Alexander Nix and Chris Kalin, in some capacity, and I don't know to what extent whose idea it was each time, but some sort of doubling down sting was introduced to make sure the campaign won. So in St Kitts and Nevis, the very thing that he spoke about on Channel 4 News of paying bribes, yes, that was a technique that they utilised in St Kitts and Nevis. I'm, you know, equally frustrated by this because it was sort of on my campaign. We didn't need to do it. We were going to win anyway. The polling was showing we were winning. It wasn't necessary. However, I wasn't the boss.
And this was a repeating what do you thing. Think would have been the rationale for doing that? Because to me, that presents two reasons to do a dirty trick if you don't need to. One would be because it makes you feel sort of cool and underhand and you're like a sort of Bond-type villain, which may sound weird, but I think people do behave like that. The other would be that you think that it would impress your clients, that your clients would think, oh, look at that, they pulled off this amazing dark masterstroke.
Well, I don't know if it was that, actually. I mean, I think that there's two potentially other explanations, which is one, in this case, arguably, I mean, if you look at the fact that in this case it was Lindsey Grant. Lindsey Grant went into...
This was St Vincent and the Grenadines.
St Vincent, yeah. Sorry, St Kitts.
St Kitts and
Nevis. You know, I mean, Lindsey Grant was approached by someone he believed to be someone who wanted to make a very substantial party donation just before an election for... essentially a corrupt land deal as a consequence, you know, which is buying prime real estate if he got into power at a reduced rate, and therefore the person was going to offer him $1 million towards his campaign when he most needed it in the last few weeks of the campaign. It is, you could argue, setting that up actually revealed the true character of that man, the fact that he took the bribe, the fact that he was then explaining that he had offshore means by which to hide the money and so forth. You know, I can see why people... That's, to some extent, no different from what Channel 4 did with Alexander Nix when they filmed him and pretended to be someone and
they
then revealed
dirty
it.
Tricks for good reason. They
exactly.
Dirty and tricks for good reason.
If Channel 4 do it and it's called journalism, if Nix or Kalin was organising that and then it's called dirty tricks. So there's a fine line there, and I'm not quite sure in that instance if you're revealing someone as being perhaps not suitable for power, is that... Where that sits on the line is a tricky one. I don't know where it sits in the law. I don't know where it sits really potentially morally. All I know for sure is, in my assessment at the time, we did not need to do that to win.
Yes.
Now, in terms of your second point, was it used to impress the client? Well, as far as my understanding is, if Kalin to some extent was organising the financing, although I think I'm sure he'd say that he wasn't or would deny
that. We haven't really explored that yet. Yeah. So
I mean, Kalin was between them, they came up with the idea. I mean, that's all I know. So whoever came up with the idea, I don't know if that was really being presented to the client as a campaign idea to impress them, or if it was being utilised as a means by which to just ensure that this man was exposed as not fit for government.
Right. And with the Lindsey Grant sting, you were directly involved.
Yes.
You organised it.
Well, I was asked to. I was tasked with it. And I was told sometimes what to do, which in instances where I didn't necessarily agree with it.
Yeah.
Which was about the same time as I started looking for another job. the CV was shooting out the door at the same time. But yes, I was personally privy to that job.
And it was, I mean, it worked, as in the sting worked, and then you posted it on the internet. And, I mean, even though, as you say, you probably would have won the election anyway, but it was a successful sting.
Well, insofar as, you know, I mean, as I said, my polling was indicating that we were going to win the election anyway. We had a good candidate, we had a better candidate than the other side in terms of Lindsey Grant. We had a better campaign, we'd run it well. We had a good structure to our campaigning. My personal assessment is we would have won it anyway. That assessment wasn't perhaps listened to in the way in which, in retrospect, I wish it had been. From the point of view of the people who considered doing that sting, would they consider that as a successful sting? Well, insofar as it revealed a man who was willing to accept a bribe, sell prime real estate in his country for a devalued price so as to gain power. There's a moral question there in terms of do the ends justify the means in that instance, I would have thought.
How many sting operations do you think you took part in or had anything to do with? How many dirty tricks, if you like, in elections for SCL, which is the parent company of Cambridge Analytica?
Well, again, I mean, in terms of, and I'm not sure if Alexander Nix did himself any favours on the Channel 4 programme in terms of this, in the way in which he described it. If we stop for a second and think, right, Amber Rudd has just had to resign because of a very hostile, aggressive push by the opposition over a sustained period of time, over 5 days, and as you know, if it goes 5 or 6 days, chances are the person's going to resign. Okay, is that dirty tricks to keep feeding the press with stories and angles and all the rest of it? No, it's just called the cut and thrust of politics. You know, is it dirty tricks for the media to have amplified Strauss-Kahn when he had a rape allegation against him? Well, the question is, was that a real rape allegation or not? You know, and so these are things that happen in politics. If someone makes a mistake and so forth, it is amplified. So, for instance, one of the occasions in St. Vincent, there was, again, I wasn't personally involved. I was running the campaign, and this was, again, I was overruled, and it was applied to my campaign from outside by the wider team, which was the amplification of the sexual assault allegations that were existing against the Prime Minister, Ralph Gonzales. Mm. It was certainly the case that Alexander Nix, Chris Kalin, a combination of the both, set about ensuring that Margaret Parsons, who is the person who alleged the sexual misconduct, was feelings and her allegations were fully ventilated on the radio and on the television and in the run-up to the referendum and election campaign.
And how would these instructions come to you? Would it be Nix emailing you and saying, do this now? Would there be some sort of...
Well, in that instance, on the Ralph Gonzales, I had nothing to do with it,
right,
and no knowledge of it, because I'd sort of fallen out ethically with them at that point, in terms of I didn't want anything to do with that kind of campaigning. So in that instance, I think Nix was tasking someone in my team directly, and they were doing it without my knowledge. And then I was presented with the fait accompli, which is, we have this video which has been created of an interview with the person making the allegations, which was filmed in America, and then that was broadcast on television in St. Vincent in the run-up. I can't remember if it was the referendum or the election. I think it might have been the referendum. Again, was it necessary? No, we had an amazing campaign that was affecting incredible behaviour change, that was really getting the people excited, which was based on credible arguments with very good candidates, resonating very well. But this, again, was a decision that was made, and I was instructed to fold it into the campaign.
But, I mean, sorry, again, we're in danger of introducing far too much complexity to a listener who probably doesn't know where we're coming from. What we're talking about here is Christian Kalin, who runs, he doesn't like the word passport selling, but a passport selling business. It's a more complicated business than that, but Hellion Partners are in the business of selling passports. Working with Alexander Nix, representing an election-winning business, working together so that they would be, as it were, on both sides of an election. They could be working with either party. And therefore, Nix wins the election on behalf of Cambridge Analytica, and then Kaelin runs the passport scheme for that country once that government is in place. That's what we're talking about here.
Assess based on the available evidence, that seems to be the structure.
That seems to be, yes. Yeah. And so when you say these sort of that Nix and Kaelin were cooking up these dark ops between things and so on, I know that you're saying a lot of these you weren't directly involved in, but how would that message come down to the people who would have to orchestrate this thing? Would it be an email from Nix? Would it be an email from Kaelin?
Yes, both and Skype telephone calls or a visit from Alexander Nix to actually push it through.
They'd never use sort of drop-offs and, you know, secret tactics or anything like that.
No, as I said, I mean, there were discrete ways to communicate backwards and forwards that were insisted on, which I'm assuming is just normal procedure in the same way Signal now exists or something of the sort for discrete messaging if you're working on a campaign. So that was the standard operating procedure, was to be fairly tight with one's communication. But yes, it would come down as a diktat, which is, this is what we're going to do. It's funded, it's going ahead, now either make it happen or it's happened and folded into your campaign.
And when did you start to ask yourself questions about Kaelin, for instance? When did you start to say, isn't this quite... I mean, you say quite early on, but you had a conversation with Nix while you were doing St Kitts and Nevis, which was your first campaign.
Yes,
is that right?
I mean, absolutely. I had issues with many of the questions I was asking were not getting adequate answers to make me feel comfortable in terms of the funding, in terms of the ethics of some of the techniques, and in terms of essentially the due care and attention of my team on the ground, who sometimes were facing quite difficult circumstances. I mean, in some of the campaigns we had armed guards by my insistence because of death threats and so forth that were apparently out there because of us.
Explain that a bit, because as far as I understand it, there were some Caribbean politicians who you were fighting against, perhaps, were saying, look, there are these white boys coming from Cambridge Analytica and they're trying to rig our elections. Mm-hmm. And then you would actually be targeted, is that what you're saying?
Yes, there were certainly threats that we were made aware of on the ground in terms of our safety, which made me insist on, for example, in one of the campaigns, on having a live-in armed guard for the team in sort of the villa where we were staying. I was deeply concerned about the operational security from Nix and raised it on several occasions. He doesn't have a military background. There's a level of due care and attention and responsibility that I felt was perhaps he was falling short on that. I explicitly stated, you're going to get someone killed on this team if you're not careful, you know, and that was definitely a part of my decision to leave. I left with the express purpose of setting up a company which was more ethically responsible, more transparent, more, you know, certainly effective in terms of using targeted communications, which I think is absolutely an appropriate way for the marketing industry to move. But this was all helping over that period of a year when I was working there to inform where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do next. So what was going through my mind was quite simply, do I go and join another company? I was talking to various companies to join them. Wasn't quite sure that was the right choice. So I decided actually to leave and set up my own company, almost in response to this, which is, and that's why we take a great deal of pride of the clients that we now represent and who we choose not to represent and what we choose to do and what we choose not to do.
But what was the moment where you felt, I mean, was there a moment where you felt you were in grave danger of being killed or that you were getting into something that was out of control? Was there a moment where was there a sort of eureka moment where you thought?
Well, there was a couple of campaigns where certainly I was undercover in one country, particularly where other people had been exited from the country who were on the campaign team, the wider campaign team, and I was the one that was left.
When you were undercover, just out of curiosity, would you pose as a journalist?
Tourist.
Tourist.
Yeah, in that case, yeah. Or just keep a very low profile. So on that particular occasion, yes, I was having to make sure I had an exit route planned, very quick exit route as necessary. And then on the subsequent campaign that I was also working on, similarly, as I said, we had, you know, an armed guard at my insistence, and I made
for the thriller lovers among us, what would be the exit route?
Either a fast boat out or a small plane from an airfield that wasn't currently being used.
So this would be, again, forgive me if I'm getting this wrong, but this would be if the mob turned on you. If a politician whipped up a mob against you, you would have a way of getting out of that country as quickly as possible.
Yes.
And that did happen?
No. I mean, we had a couple of close shaves. There was one instance where that sting, actually, that you were referencing earlier, the person who conducted the sting was still in the hotel room, and Lindsey Grant subsequently went to 10,000 people and said, the man who's just, I think, maybe stung me is in that hotel room. So I had to very quickly go around there and get them out.
You know, and tell us about getting him out. How did that...
Oh, that was just a matter of walking in, grabbing him and getting him out.
Onto a boat.
He flew out of the country, I think, the next day. Yes, we took care of him overnight and got him out the next day. Yeah.
And you talk about worrying that people were going to get killed. But in fact, someone died in suspicious circumstances. Daniel Murasan. Tell me a bit about him, how you came to find out that he had died.
Mm. Yeah, this was terribly sad for me to hear a couple of years later after having left the company. So Dan was my deputy on the election side of the business. I had brought him into the team, or I think maybe he was given to me from HQ, actually, but he came and joined my team on a couple of elections. A wonderful man, very, very good political campaigner, straight down the line, good, honourable man. We were living together under armed guard on a job, and it was quite clear that we both had reservations about our security on that job.
This was St Vincent
and St Vincent, yeah. And we were talking, you know, in the evenings we would talk about it. I mentioned to him at that point that I was going to go and set up a company. I thought there was a better way of doing this, a more responsible, more professional way of doing it from my eyes, from my opinion. And I actually asked him to come and join that. He wanted to stay because he recognised he'd get the head of elections job if I left.
Right.
But I did warn him, look, mate, just be very, very careful that you don't get yourself killed here. I then heard nothing more about Dan. I know he was promoted to head of elections. The next thing I heard about him was actually when a few years later, when once I'd left the company and set up my own company, and we were sort of roaring success doing this ethically, I actually had a phone call from Alexander Nix out of the blue saying, I'm doing something very exciting in America. Will you come and we want you, you're a campaigner we rely on or relied on, you know, will you come and work for us?
And this was the Cruz campaign or the
Trump campaign? As I later understand, it's a Cruz campaign. He didn't go into a great deal of detail, but he was saying
Cruz.
Yeah, something in America. I said to him, actually, at that point, no, I will not meet you. No, I will not work with you. No, you cannot come to my building. We will not accept you in here. We do not want anything to do with the brand SCL in connecting with our company. And we still have that. We won't hire anyone who's come from SCL or from Cambridge Analytica, and we never have and never will.
Not from you.
Apart from myself, yeah, no, as in response to it, really. And just at the end of that call, he told me, I said, oh, by the way, Dan's dead.
Beg your pardon. Did he just drop it in?
Literally, yeah. Just, and so, okay, that was a bit unexpected. You know, are you joking? What do you mean? And so his version of events was that Dan had got so drunk he had drowned in his own vomit during the Kenyatta campaign. So I immediately Googled it to try and find out the details, and it was sort of fairly shady what I was finding online. There wasn't a great deal online and so forth. So what I've heard is that he was on the Kenyatta campaign doing and died because he got so drunk he vomited. That's it. That's what I...
And Christopher Wiley has mentioned this. The Guardian whistleblower on Cambridge Analytica has mentioned this at the Parliamentary Select Committee, that he thinks that he was bumped off.
I have
died
no
in
way
suspicious
of knowing. Yeah, I have no way of knowing. I mean, I wasn't there. I didn't even know they were doing a Kenyatta campaign. Suffice to say, my experience, which was part of the reason I left, was I felt their operational security, their team security, was lax and not to the standard I was used to coming from or would expect from coming from a military background, even as a reservist, and not one that I felt comfortable having a team on the ground sort of living day by day with that level of exposure, with often, you know, when you're going into a country and taking down a government, that can sometimes be quite a hostile environment, you know.
And let's talk a little bit about empathetic linguistic techniques that you employ. I mean, as I understand, you're from a defence background, I think.
Well, I don't want to overstate that. Yes, yeah. I was a reservist.
Sure.
Be clear about
but,
that.
But the initial idea was a defence mechanism. It was a counter-terrorism technique, would that be fair to say?
In terms of SEL,
yeah.
Well, I'm not sure it was, actually. I don't know. I think Nigel was just very interested in the methodology of behaviour change. I know that they had private sector clients, that had governmental clients before, some election clients. I think he and the Behavioural Dynamics Institute, which was sort of his think tank around this, were a group of very committed psychologists and applied psychologists working in what is the best way to affect behaviour change. That was also my background separate to them before coming and joining them, and it's been my background since leaving them. You know, sorry, it's been my consequent career since leaving them. I think let's just take defence out of it. There is one application, which is defence. Mm. But the idea of creating empathy, whether or not it's to help solve terrorist problems, recruitment problems of terrorism, or whether or not it's helping politicians to communicate their manifesto more effectively to an audience that's cynical about politics, or whether or not it's bringing a brand into the lives of people in a way that's going to resonate more effectively, or whether or not it's creating empathy in peacekeeping in Northern Ireland and making both sides talk to each other, or if it's, you know, there are so many applications.
Give us one trick of the trade of how you create empathy with through language.
Okay, one. It's not a trick of the trade, but what this is a process. I've got to be clear. The methodology I have created with my company is separate from SEL. And it's just made that very, very clear. So I can only talk about what verbalization does and what we're focused on. We're focused on essentially deep listening to an audience by asking them genuinely to take part in proper research where they know who is conducting the research, they know which brand it's for, or what cause it's for, and we undergo a period of research, you know, and that can be focus groups or that can be quantitative research. And then we look at the transcripts and deep listen for linguistic traits that can help us, therefore, build messaging that's going to be more resonant with that audience. So if that's, for example, the metaphors that they choose to use, if you describe a product and you reach for a metaphor or an analogy and say, it's like something, you know, well, if lots of the people you're listening to all say it's like X or it's like Y, well, then obviously to take that messaging back to that audience, it may be good to say, this is like X or like Y. All it is sort of pattern matching what you hear them saying to present your brand, product or message in a way that's more likely to cut through and get considered by them.
Right.
That's what we do. Yeah. Now, that can be very, very powerful and can do a lot of good. So, for example, when we've used that against Daesh, against a so-called Islamic State, you know, we did a campaign online called Not Another Brother, which was we examined the ways in which Daesh were recruiting young, vulnerable, let's say, Muslim youth in this country. And we listen to the way in which they were also the target audience that they were trying to reach were talking and what they were responding to. And then we could create intervention messaging that went between the Daesh messaging and the audience by basically almost sort of play acting at some of the language of Daesh, but then leading to a peaceful solution, a peaceful outcome that would engage these people in dialogue instead of continuing the route of recruitment towards Daesh. And that was incredibly effective. Very small campaign, like cost £12,000, had 500 million media impressions in the first 7 days. It's considered one of the most successful counterterrorism campaigns ever done in online in history. Okay. You know, that's a kind of example of how much effect you can have by taking into account the language susceptibilities, language structures of people, and then trying to pattern match that with what you want to say.
But when you were working for SEL, there was no sort of counterterrorism element. It was all elections and politics.
I was doing the elections, yes. Yeah.
But they were doing
yes.
Counterterrorism.
Well, they had a defence capability I wasn't part of, but yes, they certainly had a defence wing.
Because, I mean, as I understand it from other people I've spoken to about this, that they're, you know, I think people want to paint Nix as the villain, perhaps more so than he is, perhaps less so than he is, but that Nix effectively figured out a way in which he could flog the psychological techniques to people, and he took what was Nigel Oakes's baby, as it were, and turned it into a huge money-making machine. Is it how you understand it?
Yeah, I think he was a good businessman, wasn't he, in terms of a lot of companies out there, industries would recognise the fact he took quite a difficult thing to understand, difficult thing to sell, and managed to sell it a lot. The question then, morally, that he has to answer for himself, and it's not for me to comment, is who did he sell it to? Did it do good? Mm. Was it being used to increase dialogue, or was it actually being used to increase division and separate people and fracture societies? We come from the position very much as a company that we want to do the former, which is to create dialogue, to create empathy, to hold societies together, to build them around ideas they can agree on and lead them to a positive space. But arguably, representing Le Pen may not be that. You know?
Yeah, but a lot of electioneering is inevitably creating division among the opposing party. I mean, that's
well,
what...
you can do that. You can do negative campaigning. It didn't help with the Remain side, did it? No. You know, I mean, you're right. You can, and there's a whole structure of it's called fissures and pinions in terms of psychological terms. You can put fissures in the other side to break them up, or you can create a pinion that everyone can agree on. Mm. I come from the place, both professionally, I've seen it more effective, but also morally, I think it's more appropriate, which is to try and create positive things that people can agree on and build cohesion around that and create groundswell in a positive sense, because then you're on the route to doing something good and leaving a legacy which is positive in a country. Mm-hmm. Any old fool can sing the devil's song, you know. That doesn't end in a very good place for either tactically or strategically for a country.
And when you raised concerns with Nix about this, you said he said if we told you that when we hired you, you wouldn't have joined us. Mm-hmm. I mean, did you get the impression that he thought you were naive, perhaps, in your sort of positive idea of how...
Well, I mean, quite possibly people think I'm naive trying to do good.
Not people, I mean Nix.
No, but Nix, I mean, you know, yeah. Well, generally, I mean, yeah. I face this a lot. I hope I can only demonstrate by my actions, you know, the choices I make, I'm very proud of the people that work with me, that they're also that way motivated. Time will tell whether or not I've been naive or actually helping to create an industry that we can, first of all, be proud of in this country, that aligns with the moral needs of using some of these techniques. Its professional standards are high, and something we can maybe export as soft power in an effective sell post-Brexit of an industry that we can be proud of and that brands can be proud to associate with. Mm. I don't really want to create something that, you know, we represent commercial brands, we believe very strongly in the difference between paid for journalism and proper robust journalism and fake news. That's why we represent the likes of the Times. We're very proud to have represented them and helped their business, and Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal and so forth. You know, naive or not, it's effective, and if we can take it to a positive space and a professional, almost a self-regulated space, then that is more likely actually to grow an industry that can be successful both for the exchequer but also for the progress of this behaviour change in a way that we can all be proud of and pass on to the next generation.
But with fake news, we've had a lot of accusations flying around about fake news and Cambridge Analytica and the Trump campaign. Did you ever get the impression that they were doing, or have you had the impression since working with them, have you come to realise that they were doing fake news, astroturfing, you know?
At the time, I was, because I sort of was asking inconvenient questions through my year there, I became sort of cut off from dealing with Chris Callan pretty much completely, and was set aside for some of those techniques that I've subsequently learned were being used on the campaigns that I was running. So I was perhaps naive in thinking I was running a good... clean campaign on the ground. What I've learned subsequently is some of these techniques were being applied to my campaigns. Now,
you say you were running, you thought you were running a clean campaign, but you were also doing these sting operations that you were uncomfortable with.
Well, no, I mean, actually, I didn't have anything to do with one of the stings I've just mentioned. The first one I did, but I was told I had to do it, and otherwise it's our way or the highway.
Right.
I kicked, screamed, and bit my way through that, and made it very clear on no uncertain terms of my feelings and the way that we could do it differently. Yes. So, you know, the alternative is there is to try and change it from within, which I certainly tried to do. I felt as though I was not achieving the change within that I wanted to achieve, so I left. You know, so I voted with my feet.
Let's go back to the fake news and creating fake accounts on social media accounts.
Yeah, now I've subsequently, it's been drawn to my attention by a former client who emailed me saying, we would like access, please, to these 50 fake accounts on Facebook or the, you know, can you give us access? And I was like, I didn't even know these existed. What?
That was a client from the Caribbean.
From the Caribbean, yeah. You know, and so I obviously redirected them to Alexander. I mean, so I've subsequently, as I said, been made aware that some of these techniques were being used on top of my campaigning. Now, what frustrates me, therefore, is, for example, that we lost the St. Vincent campaign by one seat. I've, for many years, woken up every morning in a cold sweat, which is right, my campaign failed, and I have a very proud track record of winning, you know, do you know what I mean? And through legitimate campaigning. And now it sort of begins to dawn on me that actually some of the things that were being applied could have had a negative effect and could have swung that seat. That makes me furious because it's my record that's somehow embroiled and taken up in some of the techniques that wasn't, that could have had an effect on the election negatively, you know.
Do you think that any sort of negative reaction to the type of campaign you were doing would have been because people sensed there were dirty tricks? Or do you think there is an element to which, with empathetic linguistic techniques, that people, that the particles know they're being watched, so that people sense that they are being manipulated,
yeah,
and they react violently against
absolutely
that?
If you don't do it, I mean, this is one of the things we always taught in the military, you know, which is credible, timely, accountable, attributable. These are incredibly important things. In PsyOps, you know, it's recognised for what it is, which is it must be accountable. You're not allowed to do black ops or grey ops. It's illegal. It's against the Geneva Convention. You only do white ops, which is attributable. Every single piece of material that you put out has a little code at the bottom to say it came from, for example, ISAF, and it can be attributed to exactly who sent
ISAF
it.
Being...
International Security Assistance Force. You know, there just isn't that culture or regulation at the moment in the private sector. And this goes back to my fundamental point here, which is, if any of this experience of working with SCL, and I look back at it with mixed emotions, as you can tell, you know, but if it taught me anything, it is the importance of corporate responsibility, of CEOs, and I'm now a CEO of a company, of people like me having the responsibility to know the difference. Just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. Mm. And if you do something, you have to be held accountable to it afterwards. And you have to say, yes, that was openly us. So if people are using bots, if they're using fake accounts, if they're using, you know, we don't do any of that, and we stand wholeheartedly against those kind of techniques. There is, however, a place, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of deep listening to an audience and creating the most resonant information for that audience to make them engage with it. No different if you've got children. I know you have children, I have children. If you want them to go upstairs and go to bed, you know, you may say to one child, I'll race you upstairs and go to bed, and the other child, you turn around and say, Daddy's going to get angry unless you go to bed.
You're creating an empathetic situation with me.
I'm saying that you need to change sometimes your messaging, even though you want the same behaviour change, by taking account and respecting the person you're talking to. There's nothing wrong with that. And I absolutely stand for that and think there is a huge potential for that as an industry going forward. I think it's where the marketing industry should be. Mm. I think it will save a great deal of wastage. And if we can create an industry that accepts its responsibilities and adopts the best practice of morally responsible, professional, effective and transparent, then that is something the world will want to buy. And Britain should be very proud of being at the cutting edge of that. That's not the same as what we're talking about in terms of fake accounts and all that data harvesting nonsense.
What Cambridge Analytica and SCL
seem to have done. Yeah.
But if they did, and it seems by your account that they clearly did.
By my account is, you know, what I've said to you is the facts of the situation, the inference from that you're drawing. What I've said to you is the facts of the situation. I think it will be both for the courts to decide and for the investigation, so as not to prejudice that investigation.
Of course. But if there is to be an accountability on this, then, you know, the people who ran companies that did these types of campaigns, that misused the techniques you're talking about, will have to be held to account and will have to...
I certainly hope so. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think as an industry, I've been saying this for a very long time, I've been giving speeches to the House of Lords about this, at RUSI about this. I absolutely believe we need to either self-regulate in a very transparent way altogether, or we need increased regulation imposed on us. I'm the first to say that, absolutely. The standards that we met in military PsyOps were so much higher and so clear and directed us in such a comprehensive way in terms of moral responsibility that I'm really proud of the work we did there and can account for all of it and I'm proud to account for all of it, and it did a lot of good. Less so in this kind of quagmire of this space that exists in the private sector. So I hope it's a combination of the big social media networks like Facebook. You know, I think it's fairly strange that Zuckerberg isn't coming in front of the select committee. I would have thought, with all the allegations flying around, that again, as a CEO, his responsibility is to come and explain the situation. Mm. I'm surprised that Nix hasn't gone in front of the select committee. I think it is his responsibility as a CEO to come and explain the situation. It is my responsibility, as I'm doing here as a CEO, to account for my past, but also to set the record straight in terms of our trajectory as a company.
With Facebook, I mean, my instinctive take on Facebook and the Trump campaign and the story, The Guardian have done a lot on this, and it's perhaps my own political prejudices, but I tend to think that there is this desperate desire to think that Trump or Brexit couldn't have happened had it not been for some magnificent psychological brainwashing that had gone on of an entire electorate. And I think that's just sort of finding an excuse for the fact that an election result happened that somebody like The Guardian wouldn't want to, an institution like The Guardian wouldn't want to happen.
I think that's highly likely. I mean, look, in terms of, I was calling both of these, both the election of Trump and Brexit, I was calling them on the day. I was talking, strangely actually, to the editor of the Sunday Times on the morning saying, Brexit has got it. We've got it insofar as I was pro-Brexit. And I was, I think, one of the very few. It was there if you deep listen to the audience. Absolutely. The hostility was there. The suppressed vote was there. The polling, the thing is, of course, the polling structures we have, the polling systems and methodologies we have, are no longer fit for purpose because of this sort of modern verbal world of social media, of text and behaviour and people being savvy and being able to know that they can lie to a polling company. Mm. If you just go on regular polling, you're not going to get the honest opinion of the people. You know, so we've got a not fit for purpose polling system, a not fit for purpose modern campaigning system in terms of the mass advertising, and therefore the KPI system is also wrong. That's, you see, where I'm excited by, for all the bad apples of potentially the Cambridge Analytica, let's not throw away the industry. The industry that has recognised, there was an emerging industry that's recognised that actually contemporary polling needs to change. It needs to go more with behavioural polling, understanding the likely behaviours of people, not what they say, but what they're likely to do despite what they say. Right. Campaigning that is designed to properly empathise with their real beliefs, not just tell them something, but actually talk with them and communicate. And then new ways to measure along the way to be more predictive and so forth. That's a fantastic thing. We should be celebrating that. There's entrepreneurship there. There's a chance to export wonderfully there for a post-Brexit Britain. Instead, what we're all talking about is Cambridge Analytica and data harvesting and all the rest of it. That's terribly sad. The way you started this interview was turning around saying, you know, a few bad apples seem to be sort of potentially sullying the whole industry. I couldn't agree more. And I hope this interview, if anything, will clarify the difference between perhaps the bad apples and some of the rest of us who have actually spent a very long time trying to create more effective ways to create empathy to lead to positive outcomes.
Sven Hughes, thank you very much for talking to us. I think we might need a part two at some point, in which case please come and join us again.
Thank you very much.